welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host Mono here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. Today I'm chatting with returning guest and Nintendo Life contributor Andrew J. Rue about Kyoto's Marufukuro Hotel. Not merely an old hotel, it was actually Nintendo's headquarters back in their Hanafuda days, and the lodging still has a lot of fun Nintendo-related things to discover. We run down everything you need to know to prepare for your visit. In the games, I finally dive into the long-running JRPG series with Atelier Ryza. And I dip my toes in the Apple Arcade pool to bring you some thoughts on Pocket Card Jockey Ride-On from Game Freak. Yes, that Game Freak. In the news, hey, forget everything else because I'm breaking down the long-awaited Nintendo Direct. Before we jump into the feature, a bit of an update. I've joined the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network. This is a group of like-minded podcasters focusing on gaming and life in Japan. Hey, that's what this podcast is about. It's being run by some of the folks over at game developer Chuhai Labs, so the network features a lot of Japan-based talent. Now, what does that mean for you, the listener? Well, after the feature, you can hear a short segment from a fellow podcaster in the network about their show. So if you've already listened to every episode of Tokyo Game Life, hey, you can also check out some other similar podcasts as well. And you can look forward to some other cool stuff in the future, like better audio quality. Hopefully. Maybe. I'll be sharing more in the future. Now, let's explore the Marufukuro Hotel with guest Andrew J. Rue. Though Tokyo is home to many of Japan's most prominent gaming companies, Nintendo has their roots firmly planted in Kyoto. Nintendo's home for over a century, Kyoto is filled with a tremendous amount of Nintendo lore and hotspots all over the city, including their old headquarters, which transformed into a hotel last year called the Marufukuro Hotel. Sadly, I haven't been able to make my way down there yet, but fortunately, today's special guest has made the trip. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hello. First of all, thank you for having me back. I'm really happy to make my second appearance. My name is Andrew J. Rue. I'm a freelance Japanese English translator, and I also occasionally freelance for the website Nintendo Life is a games journalist.
Thanks for joining me today. Let's start off with a primer. What is the Marufukuro Hotel?
Well, Marufukuro Hotel was built from Nintendo's old headquarters from 1933 through 1959, I believe, before they moved to their current location. I believe the family reached out to a developer that develops luxury hotels throughout Japan to convert it into a hotel.
Have you ever visited before it was converted into a hotel? It seems to be a fairly famous pilgrimage site for Nintendo fans.
Actually, I wasn't aware of this particular building before it was converted into a hotel. When they announced plans to convert it into a hotel, it made the news. I think I was working at the time, and my wife sent me a message with like a Yahoo News Japan article. And that was the first time I learned about it. And she was really excited to go see it because we had gotten married in December 2020 during the pandemic. And we never went on a honeymoon. Every time we thought about traveling together, a new peak would happen. And we would like cancel our plans, which is how I never managed to make it to the Nintendo World theme park, despite also pitching an article to Nintendo Life. But anyway, we had both gotten really excited about visiting the hotel because it looked beautiful based on the photos we had seen. And I had racked up about 10 days of paid leave that I was like legally obligated to take 5 days of by the end of the year. So we finally started making plans to like get out and travel together, you know, even if we didn't go to like some like really populated tourist spot. And, you know, the hotel seemed like a perfect getaway for like our very belated honeymoon.
Walk me through arriving at the hotel. Where is it in Kyoto? Does it feel kind of hidden, or is it plopped in the middle of a bunch of other hotels?
Okay, so I'm not going to get like the exact street address because that would be kind of like hard to remember, but it's about a 15-minute walk, depending on your pace. It might be a little more, a little less. Northeast of Kyoto Station, the atmosphere feels very like Kyoto. Like most of the buildings you'll pass on the way are just like normal houses where people live. But every few buildings, there will be like a traditional Japanese inn or like for Japanese tourists or like a hostel for like foreign tourists who are visiting Japan on the cheap, or there will be like a restaurant. It's in a very quiet part of the city that like you probably wouldn't go out of your way to visit unless your lodging just happened to be booked there like ours was.
The hotel was renovated and designed by Tadao Ando, a famous Japanese architect. I think for Tokyo residents, his most famous and notable creation is Omotesando Hills, which is a huge shopping complex. And the original building was built in 1933. Would you say that it still has that old-style atmosphere, or does it feel a bit more modern?
It's a little of both. The building, when we first walked in, it felt like we had gone through like a time machine and like had arrived in the 1930s. I mean,
oh wow,
the atmosphere is just off the charts. I like instantly fell in love with the place. Yet, despite feeling like a place right out of time, it has every modern convenience you could possibly want. I remember most every room that is available to the guests has like a mini fridge and an espresso machine. And I swear the espresso machine felt like something straight out of Star Trek The Next Generation. It had this touchscreen that you could dial in how bitter you wanted your coffee and how much milk you wanted in it. And yeah, so, and also the Marufukuro Hotel, the headquarters, is it's hard to describe. It's a very long but narrow building. And in fact, there are four buildings. Three buildings were originally from the old headquarters, and a new building was built by the architect that you previously mentioned. The old buildings feel very retro and very vintage, despite, you know, having previously mentioned, you know, how fancy this espresso machine was. But the new building is actually where we stayed, and that had a very modern aesthetic. It was made out of concrete, and I think it was accented by stainless steel. I remember the elevator that we took from the first floor to the second floor, where our room was, and there are only three floors in total, was very futuristic. Yeah, so it was a very strange mix of old and new. But it was also very tastefully handled.
Dialing back a bit, what was in the mini fridge? Was there anything special in there, or is it just like Coca-Cola and the typical things?
So in the mini fridge, I actually had a bottle of peach juice when I first arrived. And it was so delicious. If anybody listening has a chance to go, there's mikan juice and there's peach juice. And the peach juice is just amazing. But they have everything from like sparkling water to like wine and of course beer.
How was your room? Is it like a traditional Japanese ryokan or is it more Western style?
It is definitely Western style. Like I previously mentioned, we stayed in the new building. And the reason we did that is because we stayed in the most affordable room, which happened to be in the new building. If you want to stay in the older buildings, you're going to be charged a little more. So I can't really speak to the older buildings beyond what I've seen in photos on their website. But the new building, it felt like a really nice Western style hotel. I hesitate to call it a luxury hotel. That would be a bit of an exaggeration. But it's easily the nicest hotel I can recall staying in. It's not quite as large as the apartment we live in, but being a hotel, it didn't need more than like a bed and a TV and a bath. So it felt incredibly spacious. And I think the unusually high ceilings made it also feel a bit bigger than it really was. I also remember being struck by the fact that we didn't have to take our shoes off
when
we entered. Yeah, I think most hotels, Western style hotels anyway, that I've stayed in Japan kind of don't really require their guests to take their shoes off. I guess they cater to tourists, and they probably at this point given up on that. We still took our shoes off anyway and put on our slippers. We can't break that habit. But it was definitely Western style. Not much particularly Japanese about that. So that's something you're concerned about. You don't have anything to worry about. There's a Western style toilet. There's a very nice bath, very comfortable Western style bed.
Maybe the most intriguing element to me is their library, DNA, which supposedly houses a lot of Nintendo memorabilia. Did you get a chance to check that out? And what are some of the standout items inside?
That's what I personally was looking the most forward to myself. So of the two nights that we stayed there, I spent probably 4, maybe 5 hours total in the library. It was incredibly relaxing. It's not much bigger than maybe like a typical living room by Western standards anyway. There are just a handful of tables and a handful of chairs, and the walls, well, the wall that's not facing outside because it's a window, but the other walls have been converted into bookcases. And I spent a lot of my time at the hotel. I figured it would be kind of a waste if we were like watching TV in our, you know, very normal Western style hotel room. So I spent a good deal of time in the library. I remember reading most of a book on Gunpei Yokoi, and my wife spent her time reading most of a book on Satoru Iwata. Nice. I also played a good deal of my 3DS in there as well. There's also down the hall from the library, there's also like a self-service bar that you can relax at. And we just spent a lot of time there in the library, hanging out and soaking up the atmosphere. As you may know, there are like several display pieces from like various Nintendo products throughout its history, especially as a video game company. And that was actually a little anachronistic. The Nintendo headquarters there at the Marufukuro Hotel predates Nintendo's era as a toy company, let alone a video game company. It's where they made Hanafuda playing cards. I think long before they even secured a deal to make Hanafuda cards with Disney characters. And I think that was their way into the toy market because they could distribute it in toy stores. But yeah, I remember seeing a Nintendo 64 and a GameCube and a Game Boy on display. Disappointingly, they had a Famicom and a Super Famicom, but they were the mini console versions that I have here at home. Yeah. There were also some like strange art pieces. I remember there was one art piece that looked like they had deep fried a Nintendo Switch. I don't know how they made it, but that's what it looked like. It looked like they had taken a Nintendo Switch and put it in like a tempura deep fryer or something. And I wasn't wild about that, but my wife was an art major and she thought it was really neat. So, you know, to each his own. I also remember there being like a Game Boy, like made out of acrylic. Yeah. And like I said, we spent a good deal of time there in the library reading books on Nintendo. And there's a section of books on Nintendo, but it's actually very small. Most of the books are like, I get the impression that the hotel is wisely trying to appeal to Nintendo fans on the one hand, but also perhaps equally wisely appealing to a more general audience. And there were like a bunch of coffee table style books on like various subjects having nothing to do with Nintendo, really. I remember there are books, of course, on Kyoto, but I also remember a book on the avant-garde composer John Cage. I don't know if you're personally aware of him, but I read several of his books as a college student because I originally wanted to be a music major. But despite that, you know, I wasn't about to spend my time in the Nintendo hotel library reading about John Cage. So I stuck to the very small Nintendo section. I should also point out before we move on that I think there was only one or two books in English. I remember flipping through the book Before Mario with my wife, pointing out some of the products to her that Nintendo had made before they were such a famous video game company. But the rest of it's all in Japanese.
Do they have any of their old style Hanafuda cards on display?
Oh, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. So one of the art pieces they have in the bookshelves is like a display. It's kind of hard to describe. It's like an animated display of like a game of Hanafuda being played out. And I think they used the Hanafuda cards that they sold as like a Club Nintendo rewards. That was about it. I should also mention that their business cards that you can pick up in the lobby were also printed in a Hanafuda style. They were on very thick cardstock, the exact same size and shape as a Hanafuda card. But yeah, in retrospect, I kind of wish they had paid a little more loving respect to the history of that particular headquarters is where they produced the Hanafuda cards, and a little less on Nintendo as a toy and video game company, which of course came later.
Any good hotel, of course, has good dining. Did you eat at the hotel? What were the food options like?
Okay, so there is a restaurant inside the hotel. You actually have to walk outside in order to enter the restaurant. And you also need to book the restaurant when you book your rooms. We got the breakfast on both of the days that we stayed at the hotel. They have two options on the menu, Western-style breakfast and Japanese-style breakfast. I, of course, can't speak to their dinner, but the Western-style breakfast, I ordered both days because I don't dislike Japanese food, but I've never been a very big fan of seafood. Growing up, I just never ate it, and I know that a traditional Japanese breakfast will include seafood, so I opted for the Western-style breakfast. I don't remember how many courses it had, but I think it was like a 5 or 6 course breakfast. It was very large. They'd make something small and they'd serve it to you one at a time. I ordered the French toast, but that's not all that I ate. I remember there being a salad and fresh fruit and toast and some kind of an egg dish. Yogurt at the end, but the main course was French toast, and they had two options, something that they called ham and cheese and something that they simply called sweet. The first day, I ordered the sweet variant, and then I ordered the ham and cheese variant. I remember it being both very delicious and very filling, but I had kind of wished that they had different item on the menu besides French toast 2 days in a row. So if you book more than one day, I would recommend ordering both variants because it's probably going to be the same menu both days, or at least it was in my experience. Oh, I should also mention, besides the restaurant, very late in the evening, I think it begins at 9, and if I remember correctly, the last order is like 10 minutes before 11, but they'll make you a light meal, and they had a much wider menu for you to choose from. I remember my wife ate a traditional dish. It's a rice dish where you pour green tea on top of it.
Apparently, yes, ochazuke.
It's exactly. Apparently, it's a specialty of Kyoto, so she was really excited to eat that. I wasn't quite as hungry, so I simply ordered some ice cream. And if you can't wait until 9, there's also a kind of a self-service snack bar in the lobby where you can make yourself any kind of drink that they serve at the hotel. And they also had various snacks. I remember there being like cake and mixed nuts, things like that to hold you over. I should also mention before you move on as well, that your room also has a mini refrigerator as well, and a drawer full of snacks. And that too is included in your room free. Whether in your room or walking through the hotel, virtually anywhere you go, there will be plenty of drinks for you to enjoy, both alcoholic and non-alcoholic, and all of it is included in your hotel bill. So don't be afraid to drink as much as you can.
If you don't mind me asking, how is the pricing? I see that there is an all-inclusive package for about 100,000 yen or around $900.
I wouldn't go so far as to call it a luxury hotel, but I have seen it described as a boutique hotel, and I think that's a rather apt description. One reason we went in early December is because the specific weekend that we booked was the cheapest weekend we could find in like a four-month window. For whatever reason, they were offering a 10% discount during that weekend. But like about a week before our reservation, my wife got the idea to look into the GoTo travel campaign. Have you heard of that?
Oh, yes, of course. It's famous in Japan.
Yeah. So I think the specific campaign we used is no longer called GoTo Travel. I think it's the successor to that campaign. My wife called the hotel asking if we could participate in this campaign, and they said that they didn't know which option would ultimately be cheaper, but they would look into it for us. And I think the next day they called us and let us know that that particular campaign was in fact cheaper. So at no additional cost, they canceled our initial reservation and rebooked it under this new campaign. And thanks to that, I think we saved a little under, 30,000 yen in total, which took a good deal of the sting out of the price. So the two of us were able to stay for two nights for just under 100,000 yen. So that particular campaign, I think, is only available for residents in Japan. And we also had to give proof of being vaccinated at least three times. If you're flexible in your schedule and are willing to look for cost-saving options, you might be able to find something to justify the price of the hotel.
Recently, we've been seeing a lot of Nintendo-related locations pop up. We've got the hotel, Nintendo Tokyo and Osaka stores, Kirby and Pokemon cafes, Super Nintendo World. Is there another Nintendo-related place you'd like to see them develop in the future?
Actually, I heard a rumor, but I think I read a news article about a year ago that Nintendo is turning one of its old factories into a museum. And have you heard of this?
I believe the Yamauchi family is converting their old house or something into some sort of museum, or I think I vaguely am aware of it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm vaguely remembering something that I probably read over a year ago, but from what I recall, they're converting one of their old factories into a museum. If I'm not mistaken, I think they're going to call it the Nintendo Gallery or something like that. And they're planning to turn it into a showcase for like the various products that Nintendo as a company has developed throughout the decades, including their time as a toy maker, as well as a video game company. And that's something that I'm really excited about. I'm glad that they're already doing what I want them to do, because I really want Nintendo to show more respect for its own history and its understand the importance and celebrate the importance and the impact it's had on our own popular culture. So I'm really looking forward to the museum. I'm going to have to look into when it officially opens, but I think it's another year or two away. But that will give us an excuse to go back to the Marufukuro Hotel. I didn't mention before, but I think my first night that we were staying there, like privately in my own thoughts, I had already decided that I wanted to come back in another year. And the following morning, I think maybe it was while we were eating breakfast, I asked my wife if she wanted to come back, and she was having the same thoughts. So we've already decided to go back in another year. Hopefully we'll also be able to see this new Nintendo Museum as well.
Nice. So would you recommend staying at the Marufukuro Hotel, or do you think a visit or a pop-in is enough for most Nintendo fans?
So I'm kind of torn on recommending it for Nintendo fans for two reasons. I mean, I absolutely fell in love with this hotel at first sight. When we first walked in, I was looking for the front desk and I was confused because there is no front desk. Every hotel I've ever checked out, of course, has a front desk when you first walk in and staff is behind it. But at the Marufukuro Hotel, they converted like the office and you have to walk through the office to get to the lobby and your rooms. And the office is where the staff are, but it doesn't look like a front desk. There's nothing about it that looks like a front desk. They just left it the way it was. In fact, I remember one of the standout pieces that still sticks in my memory is like this antique punch-in clock. Like employees would come in and put their like time card in it and stamp it. And that clock is still there as well. And there's like a guest welcoming area. I assume it was Yamauchi's private office that was converted into this welcoming area. And that's where we paid our bill and did our paperwork. And I mentioned before that the atmosphere was just off the charts. It was probably the most relaxed I've ever been in my life because they served us that peach juice I mentioned earlier. Mm. And they had these like antique speakers that I assumed were refurbished, but they looked like they were straight out of the 1930s and they were playing like period appropriate, like popular jazz music. And the lighting, of course, was real mellow. And it felt like I had traveled back in time, like 80 to 90 years. And I'm somebody who really enjoys like vintage and retro things simply because they're vintage and retro. And I think I fell in love with this hotel because it was a 1930s hotel, not because it was a Nintendo hotel specifically. And it's also a bit pricey, as we mentioned before. You can find much cheaper lodging in Kyoto, if that's a concern of yours as well. And there are nods to Nintendo's history as a video game company specifically here and there, like we talked about earlier with the library, but not as much as you might expect. So if you go there because like Super Mario Brothers and The Legend of Zelda are your favorite like video games of all time, you might be a little disappointed because instead of Mario as a mascot, you're going to find like statues of like a traditional Japanese crane as a mascot. But on the other hand, if you are really interested in the history of video games and the history of Nintendo in particular, and if your love for the company and interests in its history extends further back into time than its history as a video game company, including its time as a toy maker and a playing card company, then there's a lot to recommend about the hotel. I remember feeling like a really profound connection with an era of recent history that is rapidly fading from living memory. I think this headquarters was established around the time that my own grandfather was a little boy, and he recently passed away at age 91. So, yeah, I felt a profound connection to the past. I really enjoyed it on the level of a museum and a historical building. And if that to you as a Nintendo fan sounds interesting or exciting, I wholeheartedly recommend it. But if that doesn't sound like your cup of tea, then it's a harder recommendation to make.
Awesome. Well, Andrew, thanks a lot for telling us about the Marufukuro Hotel. Where can people find you?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter. My name is @awinnerisme, me spelled M-I-I as in the Nintendo Mii's. I started that Twitter account to arrange interviews as a freelance writer for Nintendo Life. So I try to keep my tweets on topic of whatever video games I happen to be playing at the time, or living in Japan, or maybe the Japanese language itself. But I'm not as disciplined or focused as yourself. But if you're interested in some of the things I've done for Nintendo Life, I post everything I've ever done there, and I'll continue to do so. The only caveat being that I have a regular gig now, so I don't have as much time for my freelance activities as I used to. I think last year I only contributed one article to Nintendo Life, and this coming year I might only contribute one or two more as well. But, you know, hopefully I deserve your follow, and hopefully I'll have something exciting to talk about again on this very podcast. So please follow.
Great. And listeners, the links to everything are in the podcast description. Andrew, once again, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
Before we get into games, check out this show in the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network.
In today's age, you need a podcast you can trust. That's why you need Hair of the Dogcast, entertaining and well-informed discussions on both video games and beer. Meet our local podcast team. Dylan.
I'm out here on the street, Brad, and everyone's clamoring for better podcasts.
Our new rookie correspondent, Tyler.
I play The Witcher.
And I'm Brad, and I'm slowly learning to hate myself and video games. And Dylan's reporting to us live from Kingdom Hearts 3.
There's a lot of Frozen here. Too much Frozen.
Hair of the Dogcast is a podcast you can trust on your favorite podcast app every Wednesday or whenever I decide to post it.
Only on the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network.
Once again, thanks to Andrew J. Roo for chatting with me about the Marufukuro Hotel in Kyoto. Be sure to follow him on social media. The links are in the podcast description. I didn't go on any big New Year's trip, so a lot of my time was spent at home, drinking cocoa, staying warm, and playing video games. I already talked about one game I got into during the break last episode, Pikmin 3 Deluxe. Yet I also started another game at the same time and recently finished it, 2019's Atelier Ryza, Ever Darkness and the Secret Hideout. Long title, but you can just call it A-R-E-D-A-T-S-H for short, or just Ryza 1. A bit of a preview for a future episode, but I will have a feature on the Atelier series as a whole with a special returning guest in an episode down the line. But before that, I wanted to share my thoughts on Atelier Ryza. This is my first ever Atelier game. Well, that's not true, because I did play the currently unreleased Atelier Ryza 3 at Tokyo Game Show last year. I was really impressed by the game's scope, the art style, the action-oriented combat system, so I thought, well, now is the time to jump in, since Ryza 1 and 2 are always on sale. Like some of my other backlog titles, it has been sitting on my Switch for months. But after Pikmin, I finally decided to crack it open and give the series a whirl. I'm a JRPG fan, so I try to stay on top of all the different franchises, but I have to admit, there's still a lot of gaps, with Atelier being one of them. Launching in 1997 with Atelier Marie, its claim to fame is its complex crafting system, aka alchemy, and focusing more on smaller, slice-of-life type of storytelling instead of a dark lord wants to destroy everything. The first localized game was Atelier Iris in 2004 for the PS2, and well, they just keep making them. Part of the reason why I've been so intrigued with this franchise is the sheer volume of games out there. There are 24 main titles, but even more spin-offs and remakes. The developer, Gust, has been pumping out almost a game a year. Someone's got to like them. So I thought I should dip my toe in the potion pool and try to figure out what's going on in the series. The franchise had a bit of a breakthrough recently with Atelier Ryza. A lot of people attribute this to Ryza's design, but also apparently there's quite a lot of gameplay changes that make Atelier Ryza a bit more casual and newcomer friendly. There is no time limit, which was in past titles, and it has more action-oriented combat. Plus, the graphics and presentation are much higher than the past titles. And it's available on PlayStation, Switch, and PC. Typically, this has been a mostly PlayStation-only franchise, but it does have spin-offs on the DS and even Game Boy. So the wombo combo of more platforms, more streamlined gameplay, and a stellar presentation really helped this game get noticed. But yes, Ryza does have a striking design, despite blatantly stealing Ash's clothes from Final Fantasy XII. I wasn't quite sure how I'd feel about the game, but after rolling credits, I'm pleasantly surprised by how fun it is. It feels very fresh for a JRPG. The game is very surprising in a lot of ways. Yeah, your typical JRPG elements are here, turn-based battles, exploring dungeons, leveling up and whatnot, but the framing of the story, the structure of the game, how you build your characters, all of this is really unique. I don't think I've seen another JRPG with these mechanics. Atelier's main gimmick is the alchemy system, basically a very deep and complex crafting mechanic. This is not merely just to get better weapons, but every important item in the game is obtained through crafting. Want a weapon? Craft it. Need a healing item? Craft it. Bait for fishing? Craft it. Or, I suppose, what's the verb to do alchemy? Alchemize? I'm just going to say craft. The game is structured smartly in that everything you do is centered around the alchemy mechanic, so the game doesn't feel bloated or littered with a lot of busy work. All the side quests are centered around crafting an item. Bosses are overcome by buffing up your weapons to an absurd degree or utilizing something you made. Everything you pick up in the field isn't junk that you just sell or has a lot of purposes. They're all crafting materials that you use to make things. I mean, how many games have you just picking up things ad nauseum that you never ever use? But here, every single thing you grab has a purpose, even if you don't know it yet. So what exactly is Ryze's alchemy system? It kind of reminded me of the sphere grid from Final Fantasy X, albeit it is different in its execution. It's part puzzle, part strategy, all min-maxing. At first, your eyes may glaze over and it can seem overwhelming, but once you know what to do, it's really addicting. You craft items via a recipe, which is a series of nodes that you navigate by putting the right items in. Each node also has some buff or feature associated with it, allowing you to deeply customize every single item. And you can even customize materials that you can put into other recipes. Let's say the first node wants you to put in some red plants. You put that in, and that unlocks other nodes. There's one that wants animal fur, another that wants fish, another that wants some potion. You keep putting in items to navigate around the recipe and unlocking new abilities for the item. You have a finite amount of turns, so do you focus on the node that gives your item a special skill, or one that boosts existing skills, or one that opens up more slots for more skills? These are the types of things you need to think about. The whole system is centered around min-maxing and customizing items to your liking. Depending on what you put into each recipe and what you focus on, the same item can be pretty different in stats. Take an ice bomb. You could make one that delivers strong ice damage, or one with weaker ice damage, yet it slows down the enemy. Sometimes you might want to make an item that has certain abilities for a very specific enemy. The game really lets you get granular with everything. One vital thing about the game is that you often unlock recipes inside other recipes. You start off with iron ingots, but if you want steel ingots, you don't just buy the recipe at the store. You have to navigate to it via nodes in the recipe and then unlock it. I always loved unlocking new recipes because they often reveal major game-changing items. Not just weapons, but also items that let you break rocks in the field, or carry more materials, or let you fly. And since, unlike a lot of other JRPGs, no one has a healing spell, so if you want to heal your party, you need to craft healing items for your characters to use. The usage of items in this game is also very new to me, since you don't have an infinite bag that just carries 99 potions. You equip items to characters as if they were skills, and each character can only hold a few items. This really forces you to perfect those crafting recipes and make something that is going to change the tide of battle, since you can't just spam a bunch of stuff. All your weapons are solely obtained through the alchemy system as well. Most games have a balance between weapons you buy, weapons you find, weapons you craft. Not here. All is through crafting. And oddly, each character only has about 4 weapons each, which are really just straight upgrades. But the same weapon could be wildly different depending on the materials you used. Since you can chain recipes, it's often smarter not to just start at the thing you want to craft, but to start at a base item and then work your way up to the thing you want to craft. You can get even deeper by doing that for each material as well. Say you want to craft a weapon, and the base ingredient is the 3rd tier ingot. Well, you could just start from the lowest tier ingot, continuously buffing each small part, and then use those ingots to start at the lowest tier weapon to buff it even further. It can take quite a long time, but it's absolutely worth doing, and successfully crafting makes or breaks your progress in the game. The alchemy system sounds complex, and yeah, it is complex. I beat the game, but I didn't know the ins and outs 100%. But once you start doing it, you understand the importance of certain ingredients, how to stack recipes on top of each other, and you can make some truly awesome and completely customizable items that really break open the game. Ryza only has about 3 bosses, which is absurdly low for a JRPG, but each one is a hard gear check. On the first boss, I got creamed. I did maybe 20% damage to it. But I went back, crafted better items and weapons, and beat him handily. I truly doubled, if not tripled, my damage output because I got serious with the crafting system and focused on some killer items. I can see some people getting a bit frustrated with these bosses, since they are such hard walls, and you can handle your typical enemy with little problem with some subpar gear. You might say, well, now I gotta sit in the alchemy menu for an hour, but hey, that's a big part of the game. While the alchemy part is not what you're doing most of the time, it is the most important thing you're doing, and you'll be spending quite a lot of time in the alchemy menus. They also introduce some new additions to it later on, like item duplication, buffing weapons, and so on, that give you a bit of leeway when it comes to making perfect recipes. But the heart of the game is figuring out how to best take advantage of this very deep alchemy mechanic. When you're not crafting, you're exploring and fighting monsters like you do in any JRPG. However, I feel Ryza has a pretty different setting compared to a lot of other games in the genre. There's no evil empire or demon lord or anything that threatens to destroy everything you hold dear. There is certainly a crisis, and it does get high stake at the end of the game, but most of the game revolves around your daily life on the island. You play as the titular Ryza. She's a pretty fun character in that she's quite bold and silly, but also relatable. She's a teenager who is bored of living the same life on a tiny island and wants to find her passion and purpose, which she does in alchemy. She has a friend group with their own dreams and problems as well. The game is really filled with a lot of surprising scenes early on. It starts with you stealing a boat to whisk off to the mainland. Then you get grounded by your mom. Yes, Ryza has both her mom and her dad in the game. They're both still alive, which is new for a JRPG protagonist. And her dad is the most handsome person in the entire game. Then you find out your friend's dad is the town drunk. Also, these random guys just pop up out of nowhere to bully you. And later on, some crazy-looking people in leather outfits throw a bomb at a rabbit to save you. There's so many wild things that happen at the start of the game, but eventually all the pieces come together. The atmosphere as a whole is pretty laid back. It almost feels like SideQuest the game. Much of it is just Ryza hanging out with her friends, doing some errands, maybe popping into a place she shouldn't be every now and then. It's a far cry from other JRPGs, where big event after big event happens with a bunch of twists and turns and epic set pieces. When you do get to throw down in battles, they are quite fun and energetic. It has an ATB-style system, and you can swap between party members at will. A major part of the battle system is the orders, where your teammates will shout out recommendations like do magic damage or heal me. If you do it, that will unlock a special attack or combo that plays out automatically. Balancing between your item usage, completing orders, and using character spells is important and will definitely keep your attention each fight. It's not just pressing the attack and then watching animations play out. Attacks also have a combo system, so you need to time your button presses. Even though battles are not super important overall, since the game is pretty anti-grind due to your stats mostly being affected by the alchemy system, I still had a lot of fun fighting trash mobs and engaging with the bosses. The game also looks wonderful on the Switch. It has a pastel watercolor art style, and the colors are incredibly detailed. You can see the folds and wrinkles in their clothing, and everyone's got this distinct shading on them. The locations you come across are all vibrant and colorful. They especially pop on the OLED screen. It runs well too. I didn't notice any slowdown. It's a multi-platform title, but it doesn't feel like they made it for the PS4 and then downgraded it for Switch. It's kind of funny to think that the Atelier Ryza series will be a trilogy where all the games came out day and date on the Switch. When was the last time a Nintendo console got a JRPG trilogy on a single platform day and date? Final Fantasy 4-6 on the SNES? I'm glad I finally tried out this series and I'm hooked. I'm a fan. And if you're curious about the franchise, well, I think Ryza is the one to get. Ryza 3 is coming out pretty soon, and it looks a lot more ambitious and larger in scope than the past games, so I can see people wanting to just jump in there. Kind of like how everyone jumped into The Witcher with 3. For me, though, I'm going to hold off and play 2 first, because I quite like these characters and want to see them grow and change. If you like crafting systems, customization, and want a JRPG with a different spin on the genre, I definitely recommend Ryza. I cleared it after about 25 hours, but there's still a lot of post-game content. I'm going to skip that though, because I'd rather just jump into Ryza 2. If I had to criticize the game, they don't let you take screenshots during the ending. They pulled a Pokemon Legends Arceus before that game even came out. Like I said earlier in an episode, I'm going to have a feature on the entire franchise as a whole, so look forward to that. Game Freak, not content with just putting out two huge Pokemon games last year, also released yet another title. No Pokemon, but it does have these Pokemon-like creatures known as horses. I'm talking about Pocket Card Jockey Ride On, a sequel or remake or remaster or something to the original Pocket Card Jockey game on the 3DS. It came out in Japan in 2013, and shockingly, it took 3 years to localize for the West. Thankfully, they sped things up a bit, and it's available day one worldwide. Pocket Card Jockey was a digital-only title for the 3DS. A lot of other high-profile Nintendo-associated developers also put out digital-only 3DS titles, like Intelligent Systems with Pushmo and HAL Labs with BoxBoy. Yet those games will be very difficult to play soon because the 3DS store is shutting down. Game Freak actually cites this as one of the main motivations for working on this game. But now you can play Pocket Card Jockey Ride On right now on your Switch. Oh no, actually, you can't, because it's an Apple Arcade exclusive. This was a bit shocking. Why not put it day and date on Switch? Game Freak makes some of my favorite games, but I truly don't understand them sometimes. I know it will come to Switch eventually, but it's weird to just throw it on Apple Arcade first. Though maybe it's smart because it got me to sign up for Apple Arcade. I am using the 1 month free trial, so I am technically playing it for free. Just ignore the hundreds of dollars I spent on my iPhone. With the release of this game, Amazing Bomberman and Choo Choo Rocket on the platform, I thought, hey, now is the time to try my free trial. But sadly, Sega actually delisted Choo Choo Rocket last year. They're always one step ahead of me. But I have at least been playing some Pocket Card Jockey. It's a horse racing game, or Keiba as it's known in Japan. Keiba is its own subculture here, and horse racing games is a mini-genre in Japan. Super Famicom, arcades, phones, you can't escape it. It's reached the mainstream a bit with Uma Musume, where the horses are anime girls, but here the horses are horses, though some do have stylish haircuts or are robots. You play as a jockey, you know, trying to win a race. There is some flavoring around the story, but it's mostly focused on you racing over and over again. How do you race? Through solitaire, of course. The actual horse running is mostly automatic, with the speed and stamina of your horse being determined by several bouts of solitaire that you play each race. Clear out the cards and you get a big refill on your stamina and some energy that makes your horse go faster. Fail to do so, and you need to be far more conservative in positioning your horse around the track. After each solitaire round, you can sort of direct your horse to where it will run and change the difficulty as well. The game is not just being good at solitaire, but also demands careful positioning during the in-between race segment. If you put your horse too far on the outside, it might eat up stamina, but if it's on the inside, it could bump into other horses. And you could risk trying a harder difficulty to get more rewards, but if you fail, your horse is going to lose a lot of stamina that it needs for the final stretch. So it's a lot of meter management. To be honest though, I often feel that no matter what I do, the outcome of the race is a bit random. Okay, I saved up my stamina, I did well in the solitaire part, positioned my horse conservatively, and I lose. Sometimes your horse is just too slow or doesn't have the skills it needs to win. There's really no penalty for losing, but it can get frustrating to lose over and over again. After 4 years, the horse retires, and you can breed it to make new horses, which lets you min-max stats and select skills, but I still feel there is a tremendous amount of randomization to whether or not you succeed. The solitaire portion? Well, it's solitaire. You can get some fun items to do some things like highlight which cards to choose or flip through your deck until you get a card that you can use, and so on. But solitaire is not the most riveting game in the world. The best solitaire, of course, being on Windows, where clearing the game rewards you with a billion cards flying at the screen. The game looks nice with its 3D models, and a lot of the horses are indeed very cute, but I haven't been blown away by the game thus far. Maybe I'm just not getting it. I asked some friends for advice on energy and stamina management, but I find that I keep coming up short. I've read online that your first few horses are pretty weak, but the idea of grinding out horses is not super exciting to me. I'll try to stick with, though, a bit longer to see if anything clicks. I typically do enjoy Game Freak's non-Pokemon outings. I mean, they made Yoshi. Yoshi. If you have Apple Arcade, well, I don't think there's any harm in trying it out. It's a quote-unquote free game. And if you didn't buy it on 3DS, well, clock's ticking. I hope you have $8 in your account. But this is likely the definitive way to play a horse racing slash solitaire game. It'll pop up on Switch eventually, but I don't think the button controls would enhance the game all that much. It's something clearly designed for touch controls on the 3DS and a phone. I still have a few weeks left of this free trial, so I'll poke around and play some other games. Not Fantasian, though, because I am waiting for a Switch version that may never come out. But I'll still wait. I have been playing a bit of Amazing Bomberman, though, and I'll chat about that in a future episode. But that's it for games this time around. Now for the news. Time for the news. Hey, it's all going to be about the Nintendo Direct. There was also the Nintendo Financials, which normally I would dedicate some time to, but the Direct is more interesting, and this episode is already pretty long. Scarlet and Violet sold over 20 million copies, which is incredibly impressive. I am curious to see the legs on it. The game largely received solid word of mouth outside of the technical issues. Ironically, Pokemon BDSP got bumped out of the top 10, though it was outselling Let's Go, but strangely, the Let's Go titles have had better legs. I enjoy BDSP since I enjoyed Diamond and Pearl, but out of all the Pokemon titles on Switch, it is the one a lot of people are probably most content with skipping. Arceus is the best Pokemon game on Switch in my mind, and the legs haven't been too strong, which is kind of a shame. If you haven't picked up a Pokemon title on Switch, I think Arceus is the one to go with, despite it not being a traditional Pokemon title. Okay, sales are out of the way, now the Nintendo Direct. Having had some time to think about it, I feel like it was overall very, very strong. There's an absurd amount of titles I want to pick up from now until the end of July. Let's just skip to the end with the most important title, The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. We got yet another trailer, the fourth one in 4 years, and while this one showed a lot, there's still a tremendous amount of unknowns and mysteries surrounding the game. I think it is very advantageous for Nintendo to hide a lot, despite me wanting to know everything immediately. Think of all the basic info and gameplay mechanics that we didn't know were in Breath of the Wild until launch. They didn't even show dungeons, or the Blood Moon, or a million other things. It'll be the same with Tears of the Kingdom, and even some stuff that they have shown, I doubt that they would explain it before May. Okay, let's dig into the trailer. I'm very eager to watch a billion analysis videos looking at everything frame by frame, but I'll throw out some theories as well. The trailer is very, very dark, both tonally and visually. There's a lot of shots that take place at night or in dark caves, and it can be a bit hard to make out what's what. Breath of the Wild was solemn and quiet, but here Hyrule feels much more chaotic and oppressive. It starts with maybe Ganon, I don't know, waking up, and then he just summons a bunch of monsters from the moon. Maybe it's a misdirect, which I think would be pretty interesting, but it does look like the classic, hey, Ganon's back type of story, despite us whooping him big time in Breath of the Wild. I wonder how they would explain the whole, oh, actually Ganondorf and Calamity Ganon are different or something part of the story. But the baddies are back, and they're more gnarly than ever. We see quite a few new enemies here, such as maybe a Redead, one of my most hated enemies ever. There's also a shot of a three-headed fire dragon on a bridge, very Elden Ring-like. This is probably Gleok, which was a Hydra dragon from the first Zelda game. Just like how they brought Lynels back from Zelda 1, it seems like they're also bringing back a few more old-school enemies, which is really exciting for Zelda hardcores. I want to see the Gibdos come back. Show me those mummies. There's also these flying bat dragon monsters that I think will probably have different elements, kind of like Keese. We see the good old Bokoblins, but there's a bigger one called Boss Bokoblin in Japanese. And all the enemies from the previous games have had some sort of visual upgrade with their horns, and they emanate some malice. There's a few shots of enemies underground, so it looks like we'll be going all over in this game. This section is the, hey, what's that portion of the podcast. There are some leaning towers with spotlights in the overworld. Also, the Nazca Valley-esque designs return, with some glowing, some not. Is this marking something that we can interact with in some way? There also seems to be pools of malice in the overworld and underground. In a brief shot, we saw a Bokoblin mining some ore, and there's some blue flames on the ground. The underground portion looks crazy with these mushroom trees and these glowing roots. What's going on here? We saw these swirling green spirals a few times, maybe warp points or shrine replacements. We haven't really seen any type of shrine or puzzle-focused gameplay at all, despite it being such a big part of the original game. There is some brief shot of us controlling something to make a platform rotate, but it looks outside and not like a segmented portion of the game like shrines were. There's also a huge orb in the sky, and a huge cube, and then another cube on the ground. There's these massive sky columns, and something that looks like Death Stranding strands, tents, things falling from the sky. The trailer is overflowing with a lot of new ideas and concepts, It's almost overwhelming. In a single shot, there's maybe four completely different things going on. I wonder if maybe it's a bit too busy. In Breath of the Wild, there's a good flow between negative space and points of interest, but the overworld looks far more cluttered and busy here. I wonder how this is going to translate to actual gameplay. Perhaps the biggest surprise is that you can seemingly create your own makeshift vehicles. We see Link fishing a wheel out of the water, and then he's driving a car that looks like something that you can slap together with parts. There was also a flying drone Link was controlling, along with a hot air balloon, which all radiated with that green energy. So yes, Zelda is borrowing from Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts. Us Nintendo fans were way too harsh on that game, it seems. This is, well, quite the major addition to the game. The joy, the challenge of traversal was one of the best aspects of Breath of the Wild. I liked how raw it was, how you had to navigate a lot of the world by foot. But now you've got cars and planes and who knows what else. I'm sure someone will make a mech. Maybe the final boss is just a big kaiju battle. I wonder how we are going to be using these vehicles. Is it purely just to make traversal faster, or will it be integrated into the combat or puzzle solving as well? Link just driving a janky car around Hyrule instead of walking, or using a horse, is such a bizarre concept to me. I'm trying to think of what's the coolest thing you could make. A submarine? A jet ski? Something a bit more hidden is the possibility of Link also being able to create his own weapons. If you look closely at the scene of Link hitting a monster underground with a big cannon, the weapon he is wielding looks like it's made out of three distinct parts. A gray handle, a gold metallic metal staff part, and then a Zonai-looking head cannon. The metal part and the cannon are connected via a magic circle, and I don't think this is a coincidence. This looks like something I've long suspected was in the game, weapon crafting, or the ability to recycle parts of weapons to make new ones. Weapon durability got a lot of criticism despite it being a great mechanic, so I think this is Nintendo's way of appeasing everyone. Weapons can still break, but you can reuse their parts. Not only that, you can make completely customizable and unique weapons with these parts. In the second trailer for the game, there's a shot where Link has something attached to his shield, and the staff cannon thing further proves that this is some sort of Lego-like snapping parts together to make a new weapon type of feature. Also, if you look closely at the enemies, they all have some sort of unique new horn, right? However, the Bokoblin horn kind of looks like a spearhead, and the boss Bokoblin very clearly has what looks like an axe type horn. So I'm thinking that you can defeat enemies and take their horns or other parts to strap together and make new weapons. I'm way more hyped for this than the whole new vehicle thing. I mean, you're using weapons a lot more than you're using vehicles, right? The game looks very ambitious, and it doesn't feel like a retread of the first title, something a lot of people feared. It's seemingly jam-packed with new mechanics and challenges. Will it be as good as Breath of the Wild? To be honest, I doubt it. That was a very special game, and it's hard to repeat the feeling it evoked. But a Galaxy to Galaxy 2 situation? I can't complain if we get the Galaxy 2 of the Zelda franchise. It's my most hyped game, the game I want to play more than anything. No one can announce anything that would supersede it, so I cannot wait for May 12th. But believe it or not, there were games that were not Zelda in the Direct, and they still look pretty good. Next to Zelda, I'm excited to play Pikmin 4, which is coming in July. We got a pretty lengthy trailer showing off some new mechanics and two big new additions, Ice Pikmin and a dog-like creature known as Ochi. The Ice Pikmin? Well, they do ice things. They can freeze water, and they can sub-zero enemies to make them shatter. The dog seems to be like a mix of different Pikmin types. It's strong like the purple Pikmin, but can also traverse water like the blue Pikmin. Out of all the things to add to Pikmin, I never thought, hey, they should put a dog in the game. But it does add a more unique element than just putting in more Pikmin. According to the promo art, all the previous Pikmin types seem to be returning in Pikmin 4. Three had white and purple Pikmin, but not in the main story and only in mission mode. I wonder if we will be able to use all 8 Pikmin types plus Ochi in the main story. Realistically, it's hard to have a whole lot of different Pikmin types with you at all times. If you have 8 types, that means you're carrying around 12 each, and we all know how fragile those Pikmin are. Another thing that stuck out to me is the setting, which seems to be in a much more urban area than in the previous games. We can clearly see a house in the background, a playground, and some beautiful sakura trees with falling blossoms. I want to go in the house. That would be a pretty fresh idea for the series. We are going into caves, it seems, which may be returning from Pikmin 2. The structure of the game is pretty vague. Is there still a time system? Is there a day limit? I didn't see us picking up fruit, so is that still a mechanic? We also got a tease of nighttime, where the Bulborbs go crazy due to what can only be described as a blood moon. Also scattered around the nighttime scene is Konpeito, Japanese sugar candy. If you played Animal Crossing, these star fragments are based on them as well. It's really cool to see these Japanese cultural items appear in these mainstream games. Being able to explore at night would be completely new for the franchise, but I wonder what the incentive would be. Maybe there are items you could only pick up at night, like the Konpeito, that you need in your quest. In terms of control, while the camera is closer to the character, the same pointer system from the past Pikmin game seems to be still in place. Maybe it's just me, but it did look like you could hurl Pikmin faster than before. I wonder if there'll be any control revamp due to the new camera angle. But either way, I'm excited for Pikmin 4. I'm hoping co-op is still a big part of the gameplay since I had a ton of fun with 3 Deluxe's co-op. Also looking forward to those Ochi plussies hitting Nintendo Tokyo. Those were the two biggest things for me, so let's just run down the list. Xenoblade 3 is getting a new character. Good for them. There is a DLC tease of older versions of Shulk and Rex. So hey, if you need new characters for the next Smash game, here you go. I've only played Xenoblade X and liked that game, but I never felt the urge to jump back into the franchise. Maybe one day, though. Next, we got Samba de Amigo Party Central, something I think was on nobody's bingo card. I played the original game on the Dreamcast with the maracas, and it is a very fun rhythm game and one that makes perfect sense for the Switch. Someone's got to make a maraca peripheral for this game, right? In about 20 to 30 years, the retro game hunters are going to have a field day with all the weird stuff that was made for Switch. Though peripherals are always more fun when they are official. That's why everyone loves the DK Bongos, which, by the way, you can buy very cheaply at pretty much any hard-off in Japan. These types of motion-slash-exercise games have been incredibly successful on the Switch, so I can see this game being a sleeper hit. Next up was not Style Savvy, but Fashion Star from Marvelous. However, the developer is Sin Sophia, the creators of Style Savvy, so it is Style Savvy in all but name. Not sure why Nintendo didn't just make another Style Savvy game, but I'm glad Sin Sophia is getting some work. Sin Sophia is formerly AKI, by the way, the creators of all those amazing pro wrestling games on the N64. And they are Tokyo-based, so I gotta give them a shout-out on the podcast. I mean, the game looks perfectly fine. If you like fashion and dressing up, here you go. We got to look at the Castlevania DLC for Dead Cells, which is the closest thing we may get to a new Castlevania game for a long time. Plus, Ghost Trick is coming to Switch. This is one of those games with a hugely vocal fanbase, and I'm glad it's getting another shot. Put that Monster Hunter money to good use. Next was Deca Police from Level 5. Actually, let me just make this the Level 5 section. It's a detective RPG where you're a group of maybe cops, and you solve mysteries and fight it out in a classic JRPG-style turn-based battle. The art style screams Level 5, that sort of rounded anime aesthetic with high production values. There's also quite a lot of these anime-style detective mystery games. Was Danganronpa secretly the most influential game of the past decade? I really like the setting in a modern, if not full-blown, futuristic city. Deca Police is coming out this year, hopefully at least. And Level 5 came back with a vengeance, showing off Fantasy Life, the girl who steals time, and Professor Layton and the new world of Steam. Layton they barely showed since who knows when that's coming. But we did get 3 high-profile titles from Level 5 that's always on the brink of either bankruptcy or massive success. Megaton Musashi was a huge whiff by them, but I'm glad they are still balancing their old stuff with their new IPs like Deca Police, which was probably the most interesting title they showed off. I like a lot of the Level 5 games. They are often well-made with strong art styles. Maybe one too many systems, and they do sort of feel like they are made by committee, but there's a lot of talented developers over there. I think their main flaw, of course, is not getting serious with Western releases. They seem to believe for a long time that they only need the Japanese market to thrive, which is absolutely not true these days. I think many have forgotten, but those Layton games took a year plus to hit the States, when now everything really should be the same day worldwide. Level 5 did set up a Western branch, but it shuttered a few years ago, and you can read impressions by people who worked there. It seemed to be poorly managed. I'm a bit surprised Level 5 never hitched their wagon to Nintendo in a big way, either trying to get Nintendo to publish more of their titles, or maybe working on a Nintendo IP or spinoff, especially since so many of their titles are kid-focused. Hopefully we can see more titles from Level 5 that have a bit more consistent worldwide release dates. After that, we saw Bayonetta Origins, which is definitely a strange spinoff, but fans seem to be hyped for it. And a bit surprisingly, we got our first look at Splatoon 3's DLC. Not merely just story DLC, but a whole new expansion pass. Wave 1 is Inkopolis, which is an alternate hub stout after the first game. Some big-time nostalgia for Splatoon diehards, but this is easily one of the strangest pieces of DLC I've seen from Nintendo. It's a hub skin. Has any game ever sold a hub skin before? As part of the DLC bundle, I suppose it's just a fun bonus, because the big thing is Side Order, which we don't know a whole lot about, but I can only presume is like the Octo expansion for Splatoon 2. Once again, we see Agent 8, but in a colorless white world that looks similar to the hub for Splatoon 2. We already know that Marina and Pearl will play a big part due to the original announcement, and you can see some brief shots of them here. Theory time. Obviously, in a game where you shoot colorful ink, if you are brought to a completely white and sterile world, yeah, you're going to ink it up and put some color back into it. The look is also reminiscent of bleached coral, where colorful coral turn white in warm water and is more likely to die. Since coral kind of looks like a brain and there's a very brainy shot in the trailer, I think it might have something to do with the Octolings being brainwashed previously when they were working for DJ Octavio. The game might take place inside Agent 8's mind. The Octoling as bad guy story is done in Splatoon, so I wonder what is incentivizing them to return. Another thing on my mind is the word order. The last Splatfest in Splatoon 2 was Chaos versus Order, with Chaos winning. This inspired the visual design of Splatsville, so maybe we get a glimpse of what Order would have looked like if it won. This is all just speculation, and I'm sure whatever the team is cooking up is far crazier and more exciting than what I just said, but if it's anywhere as good as Octo, it will be worth picking up. After that, we got Illusion Island starring Mickey and friends. I'm not a Disney adult by any means, but I think the animation looks very striking here, and it could be a solid platformer. Fire Emblem also got some new emblems, including Hector, who has one of the best attack animations ever. I am still playing Engage, so this would theoretically be the time to buy the DLC to get the extra stuff in the game, and emblems are incredibly useful, but I think I will sit out this DLC. If they add Wario, though, I'll be there day one. Don't Nod, the team behind Life is Strange, also revealed Harmony: The Fall of Reverie, which is a modern fantasy-tinged visual novel type of game. Life is Strange was great, but I've kind of fallen off this genre. Visually, it looks pretty new and refreshing, so hopefully VN fans will enjoy it. Octopath Traveler 2 looks great, and We Love Katamari Reroll plus Royal Reverie, which is a remaster of the second Katamari game. I've only played two Katamari titles, and out of those, We Love Katamari is easily the best one. I had the first Reroll on Switch, and it's a solid remaster of a great game, so I'll definitely be grabbing this one as well. There's a new mode where you can play as a young King of the Cosmos, everyone's dream come true. Then we saw Sea of Stars, which is an amazing looking JRPG with beautiful pixel graphics. Omega Strikers is a free-to-play Windjammers lookalike. Not sure if this is the best time to be launching an online free-to-play multiplayer title, but good luck to it. Layton wasn't the only DS franchise to return. We also saw Etrian Odyssey Origins Collection, HD versions of the first three Etrian titles. This is a franchise famous for its intense dungeon crawling and the fact that you draw your own maps. It's translated to Switch by having the left half be the game and the right half be the map, so you still get kind of a dual screen feeling somewhat. How much do you think this game is? Take a guess. If you said $60, you're wrong. It's $80. You can buy them individually for $40 each, but geez, $80? Is this game $10 better than Zelda? Oh, which I didn't mention, by the way. Zelda is now $70, which is kind of, I don't know, expected. You knew that once somebody in the gaming industry started to make $70 games, everyone else would follow suit. It was just like paying for online. I want to be mad about it, but I don't know, it just felt inevitable. And Advance Wars also showed up with a new release date of April 21st. They oddly didn't show any actual gameplay, just what I assume is the opening cutscene. And sad to say, there still doesn't seem to be a Japanese version. The franchise has had a tumultuous Japanese release date history, even though it was created by Intelligent Systems, a Japanese developer. It's a bummer that Japanese Advance Wars fans aren't getting a chance to experience it, but at least I can play it. It's a day one purchase for sure. Kirby's Return to Dream Land Deluxe also has a special Magalore mode where you slowly regain your power. This is post-game content, similar to Revenge of Meta Knight in past games. Playing as the villain is a really cool concept in general. Just imagine if you could play as Marx. I never played the original, and I was thinking about skipping this title, but there are so many additions to the deluxe version, and now I'm leaning more towards picking it up. I'm still not Kirby'd out. Honestly, the biggest selling point is the four-player online Samurai Kirby, the only game that requires actual skill. And after years, Game Boy and Game Boy Advance are now available for Nintendo Switch Online. As expected, Game Boy and Game Boy Color are the normal NSO tier, with GBA being on the expansion pack. Kind of a lean offering at the start, but it does look like they are planning on putting a lot of prominent titles on the app, GBA especially. It launched with Mario & Luigi Superstar Saga, a full-blown JRPG adventure, plus Minish Cap, which, yeah, is a 15-plus hour Zelda game that is excellent. Games like Fire Emblem and Golden Sun are coming down the line as well. The GB had some weird titles like Alone in the Dark, but you've got Link's Awakening DX and Wario Land 3, two of my personal favorite games. Pokemon TCG is coming, and even Kirby Tilt and Tumble. I wonder if they're just going to utilize the Switch's gyro, or if it will be purely button controls. I've already put a bit of time into these games, and they look great on a TV, especially the GBA titles, with those big, chunky pixels. I never knew I needed to play Kuru Kuru Kururin on my TV, but I did. Finally, you can play a version of Mario Brothers on Switch with good physics. This was a huge addition to the NSO service, but there's still a ton of first-party titles that are missing and weren't teased. I want that obscure stuff. Give me Mole Mania. There are some differences between the NA and Japanese versions. Japan has the Game Boy Yakuman, and it will get the Roy Fire Emblem title down the line, along with For the Frog the Bell Tolls, which I talked about in depth on this very podcast. But there is a glaring omission. What could it be? Oh, that's right. Maybe the game that breathed new life into the Game Boy, Pokemon. We saw TCG, but I'm talking about the big boys. We are a few weeks away from Pokemon Day, so I wonder if they will maybe announce a completely separate Pokemon NSO app, or maybe they will be sold individually, or perhaps it's just not going to be available at all. I always thought it was crazy to launch a Game Boy app without the most iconic, important game, but the Pokemon Pi has a lot of fingers in it, so it's not as easy as slapping Kirby's Dream Land on it, for example. I don't see so many people outraged by the lack of Pokemon, but it will always be a glaring omission. Either way, I'm super excited to play Game Boy titles on my Switch. I still have my Analog Pocket though, so I think I will save some of the more obscure titles for that platform. Nintendo followed that up with Metroid Prime Remastered, available now. Remember Metroid Prime? Well, it's back, and remastered. It has a myriad of control schemes, including dual stick controls. But I would recommend you try the Wii-style pointer controls. These work really well. Metroid Prime is a great game, but not one I'm dying to revisit. But I am glad people can experience it for the first time. Keep that guide handy. Then we saw Master Detective's Archives, Rain Code from the Danganronpa people. Looks stylish, but not really my type of game, but I know the genre has a lot of fans. You know what type of game I am into, though? Weird JRPGs with card systems. Baten Kaitos 1 and 2 are getting remastered for Switch. There was a rumor that Monolith Soft was remaking the first title, but that seems to be untrue since it's instead a remaster of two games. Honestly, if I had to choose, I think a from-the-ground-up remake of the first game would be more interesting than both games remastered. I want to buy the collection, but realistically, I am only clearing the first game. But it's a big gap in my GameCube mental library, so now I can finally play it on Switch, so hurrah! There was a sizzle reel of a bunch of other games, including WSBC Power Pros, which is the first localized Power Pros title in years, and is for whatever reason is available now on Switch for $1, so I might check it out. The last big piece of news I want to talk about is Wave 4 of the Mario Kart 8 DLC, which includes Birdo and an incredible-looking Yoshi's Island stage. All the iconic enemies and characters from Yoshi's Island have returned in glorious high definition. This track looks absolutely stunning and has some cool mechanics like creating bridges and who knows what else. Nintendo has really blown away expectations with this DLC. Originally, it just seemed to be like old tracks, which is good enough, but we are getting a lot of original tracks and now new characters. Is Kirby next? I hope so. Oh, and there were quite a few titles that only appeared in the Japanese Nintendo Direct. Natsumon, a game developed by Kaz Ayabe, who created the Boku no Natsuyasumi series. Not a far cry from that game, it's also about a kid enjoying his summer vacation. There's Paranormasight, a Square Enix horror adventure game that's coming out in the West in March. A remake of Atelier Marie, the first Atelier game. Hey, good timing. And the big boy, Momotaro Dentetsu World, the sequel to the multi-million-selling Momotaro Dentetsu Switch game. This time, you step out of Japan and take your train across the world. I doubt it will replicate the first game's success, but even if it sells half as much, it would still be an absurd amount of sales. Man, what a Nintendo Direct. I go back and forth on, should I talk about everything or should I just talk about what I liked? But there was just so many interesting games that I wanted to pick up. Nintendo showed off a lot, but I was more intrigued by what they didn't show. We didn't have a single new, previously unannounced game from Nintendo here. I'm not counting the Prime Remaster since that's just a remaster. If you compare it to last year's February Direct, that had Nintendo Switch Sports, Mario Strikers Battle League, and Xenoblade 3. But nothing like that this time around. I don't want to jump the gun here, but to me it seems like Nintendo is clearly focused on developing software for the Switch's successor. I don't want to open up the Switch 2 can of worms, but this was certainly a peculiar Direct despite it having a ton of games I want to play. Can you believe that we were just 3 months away from Zelda? I'll do my best to survive until then. Alright, let's wrap it up. What a huge episode. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well, it really helps with visibility. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on February 26th. See you next time. Matane!